we present great stories from around the globe by some of the world's favorite writers in Springbok Library of the Air.
Many years ago, I contracted an intimacy with a Mr. William Legrand. He was of an ancient Huguenot family and had once been wealthy, but a series of misfortunes had reduced him to want. So he left New Orleans, the city of his forefathers, and took up his residence at Sullivan's Island near Charleston, South Carolina. Not far from the eastern or more remote end of the island, Legrand had built himself a small hut, which he occupied when I first, by mere accident, made his acquaintance. This soon ripened into friendship, and I frequently visited him and the old Negro called Jupiter, who had been freed before the family misfortunes, but who continued to wait upon his young Massa Will, as he called Legrand. One October, just before sunset, I scrambled my way through the evergreens to the hut of my friend, whom I had not visited for several weeks, and upon reaching the hut, I rapped, and getting no reply, sought for the key where I knew it was hidden, unlocked the door, and went in. A fine fire was blazing upon the hearth, so I threw off my overcoat, took an armchair by the crackling logs, and awaited patiently the arrival of my hosts. Soon after dark they arrived, with Jupiter grinning from ear to ear, carrying two marsh hens for supper. Legrand seemed in a state of excitement.
Jupe and I have found the most remarkable scarabaeus. One that is totally new, I believe. Tomorrow, I shall have your opinion on it.
And why not tonight?
If I had only known you were here. As I was coming home, I met a lieutenant from the fort, and very foolishly, I lent him the bug. So it will be impossible for you to see it until the morning. Stay here tonight, and I will send Jupe down for it at sunrise. It is the loveliest thing in creation.
What? The sunrise?
Oh, nonsense. No, the bug. It's of a brilliant gold color, about the size of a large hickory nut, with two jet-black spots near the back.
There ain't no tin in them all, Massa Will. I keep a-telling on you. The bug is a gold bug, solid every bit of him, inside and all, except his wing. Never feel half so heavy a bug in all my life.
Well, suppose it is, Jupe. Is that any reason for your letting the birds burn? The color is really almost enough to make you think it is a gold bug. You never saw a more brilliant metallic luster than the scales emit. But of this you cannot judge until tomorrow. In the meantime, I can give you some idea of the shape.
Legrand seated himself at a small table on which were a pen and ink, but no paper. He looked for some in a drawer, but found none. Then he drew from his pocket a scrap of what I took to be very dirty fool's cap, and then proceeded to make a rough drawing upon the paper with his pen, and handed it to me when it was finished. Just as I took it, Jupiter opened the door and let in Legrand's large Newfoundland dog, which rushed upon me and loaded me with caresses, for I was a great favorite with him. When I finally turned my attention to Legrand's drawing, I was greatly puzzled. Well, this is a strange scarabaeus, I must confess. New to me. Never saw anything like it before. Unless it was a skull or a death's head, which it more nearly resembles than anything else.
A death's head? Oh, yes. Well, it has something of that appearance on paper, no doubt. The two upper black spots look like eyes, eh? And the longer one at the bottom, like a mouth? And then the shape of the whole is oval.
Perhaps so. But, Legrand, I fear that you're no artist. I'll have to see the beetle itself if I'm to form any idea of its appearance.
Well, I don't know. I draw tolerably. Should do, at least. And I flatter myself I am not quite a blockhead.
But, my dear fellow, you're joking, then. This is a very passable skull. Indeed, I may say that it is a very excellent skull, but I don't see anything of a beetle. And where are the antennae?
The antennae?
Yes.
Surely you must see the antennae. I made them as distinct as they are in the original insect. And I presume that is sufficient.
Well, perhaps you have. Still, I don't see them. I handed the paper back to him, which he took very peevishly and was about to crumple and throw it into the fire when a casual glance at the design seemed suddenly to rivet his attention. For some minutes he continued to scrutinize the drawing minutely where he sat. At length he arose, took a candle from the table, and proceeded to seat himself upon a sea chest in the farthest corner of the room. Here again he made an anxious examination of the paper. Presently he took from his coat pocket a wallet, placed the paper carefully in it, and deposited both in a writing desk, which he locked. As the evening wore away, he became more and more absorbed in reverie, so I thought it proper to leave. It was about a month after this when I received a visit from Jupiter. I'd never seen the good old Negro look so dispirited, and I feared that some serious disaster had befallen my friend. Well, Jupe, what's the matter now? How is your master?
Why, to speak the truth, Master, he's not so very well as he might be.
Not well? Oh, I'm sorry to hear it. Well, what's wrong?
Well, Master would say nothing at all in a matter with him. But then what makes him go by looking this way here, with his head down and pale as a ghost? And then he keeps studying all the time.
He keeps a what?
He keeps studying the figures on the slate. The queerest figures I ever did see. I was getting to be scared, and it all started the very day you was there.
What do you mean?
Why, Master, I mean the bug.
The bug? Confound it, what are you talking about?
The bug! I'm very certain that Master been bit somewhere about the head by that gold bug.
So you think, then, that your master was really bitten by that strange beetle you found? And that the bite made him sick?
I don't think nothing about it. I knows it. What'd make him dream about the gold so much if he ain't been bit by the gold bug? I've heard about them gold bugs for this.
But how do you know he dreams about gold?
Oh, I know. Why? 'Cause he talk about it in his sleep. That's how I knows.
After this rather long conversation, Jupiter got around to his real purpose for the visit and handed me a letter from Legrand, addressed to me.
My dear fellow, why have I not seen you for so long a time? Since I saw you, I have had great cause for anxiety. I have something to tell you, yet scarcely know how to tell it. Or whether I should tell it at all. If you can, in any way, make it convenient, come over with Jupiter. Do come. I wish to see you tonight, upon business of importance. I assure you that it is of the highest importance. Ever yours, William Legrand.
There was something in the tone of this note which gave me great uneasiness. What could Legrand be dreaming of? What business of the highest importance could he possibly have to transact? Without a moment's hesitation, therefore, I prepared to accompany Jupiter. Upon reaching the wharf, I noticed a scythe and three spades, all apparently new, lying in the bottom of the boat. We crossed to the island and made our way to Legrand's small hut. It was about 3 p.m. when we arrived. Legrand had been awaiting us in eager expectation, and he grasped my hand nervously.
Good to see you. I'm delighted you've come.
Well, I hope this time to set my eyes upon your remarkable scarabaeus. Do you have it now?
Oh, yes. I got it back from the lieutenant the next morning. Nothing should tempt me to part with it. Do you know that Jupiter is quite right about it?
In what way?
In supposing it to be a bug of real gold. This bug is to make my fortune, to reinstate me in my family possessions. Is it any wonder, then, that I prize it? Jupiter, bring me the gold bug.
Yes, Master Will.
The beetle had 2 round black spots near one extremity of the back and a long one near the other. The scales were exceedingly hard and glossy, with all the appearance of burnished gold. The weight of the insect was very remarkable. And I could hardly blame Jupiter for his opinion that it was truly a gold bug. what to make of Legrand's opinion that it was to make his fortune, I could not for the life of me tell.
I sent for you that I might have your counsel and assistance in furthering the views of fate and of the bird.
My dear Legrand, you're certainly not well. Perhaps you should go to bed and rest for a few days until you get over this fever.
Yeah, feel my pulse. Feel it.
Yes, yes. It seems to be normal, but you may be ill and yet have no fever.
You're mistaken. I'm as well as I can expect to be under the excitement. If you really wish me well, you will assist me.
In what way?
Very easily. Jupiter and myself are going upon an expedition into the hills, upon the mainland, and we shall need the aid of some person in whom we can confide.
And does this infernal beetle have some connection with your expedition into the hills?
It has.
I can't be a party to such an absurd...
Well, I'm sorry. Very sorry. For we shall have to try it by ourselves.
You must be mad. How long is this expedition?
Probably all night. We shall start immediately and be back, at all events, by sunrise.
Will you promise me, upon your honor, that when this freak of yours is over and the bug business settled to your satisfaction, you'll return home and follow my advice implicitly?
Yes, yes, I promise. Now let's be off. We have no time to lose.
We started about 4 o'clock, Legrand, Jupiter, the dog, and myself. Jupiter carried the scythe and the spades, and his sole words during the entire journey were complaints about the bug. I carried a couple of lanterns while Legrand contented himself with the beetle, which he carried attached to the end of a bit of cord, twirling it to and fro with the air of a conjurer as he went. We crossed the creek at the head of the island by means of a skiff, and ascending the high grounds on the shore of the mainland, proceeded in a northwesterly direction through an excessively wild and desolate tract of land. Legrand led the way, pausing only for an instant here and there to consult what appeared to be certain landmarks of his own contrivance upon a former occasion. At last, we reached the foot of an enormously tall tulip tree.
Well, look at this.
Yes, I've never seen such a tree.
You think you could climb it, Jup?
Yes, master. Jup climb any tree he ever see in his life.
Then up with you as soon as possible, before it's too dark, to see what we are about.
How far up, Master Will?
Get up the main trunk first, and then I'll tell you which way to go. And here, take the beetle with you.
The bug, Mr. Will? The gold bug? Why tote the bug way up the tree? Darned if I do.
What? Why, you aren't afraid to take a hold of a harmless little dead beetle. You can't even carry it up by this string.
Me feared of the bug? What I care for the gold bug?
Here Jupiter took hold of the extreme end of the string, and keeping the insect as far from him as possible, began to climb the tree. After a considerable effort, Jupiter wriggled himself into the first great fork of the tree, some 60 or 70 feet from the ground.
Which way now, Master Wheel?
Keep going up the largest branch. The one on this side.
Jupiter disappeared into the thick foliage higher up the tree.
How much farther?
How high up are you? Never mind the sky. Count the limbs below you on this side. How many limbs have you passed?
One, two, three, four, five. I don't pass five big limbs.
Then go one limb higher. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Now, Jup. I want you to work your way out upon that limb, as far as you can. If you see anything strange, let me know.
Yes, sir.
By this time, what little doubt I might have entertained of my poor friend's insanity was put to rest. To force poor Jupiter up this giant tulip tree in the middle of a desolate wilderness, carrying a gold bug and counting limbs as he went, convinced me that Legrand was stricken with some kind of lunacy. But then Jupiter shouted down,
"Ain't
it all the way.
Did you say it was a dead limb, Jupiter?
Dead in the toenail.
Oh. What in the name of heaven should I do now?
Do come home and go to bed. It's getting late, and besides, you'll remember your promise.
Jupiter, try the wood with your knife and see if you think it's very rotten.
Him rotten, Master, sure enough. But I might venture out upon it there myself.
By yourself? What do you mean?
Well, I mean the gold bug. It's very heavy.
Jupiter. Now listen. If you'll go out on the limb as far as you think safe and not let go of the beetle, I'll make you a present of a silver dollar when you get down.
On go. Brown's most out to the end now.
Out to the end? Did you say you're out to the end of that limb?
Soon to be the end. Oh, Lord, God Almighty. What is this here upon the tree?
Well, what is it? A skull, you say? How is it fastened to the limb?
Well, upon my word, there's a great big nail in the skull. What fastens it onto the tree?
Pay attention now, Jupiter, and do exactly as I tell you. Find the left eye of the skull.
That's your stupidity.
Do you know your right hand from your left?
Yes, I know that. My left hand is the one I touched the wood with.
Your left eye is on the same side as your left hand. Huh? Now, have you found the left eye of the skull?
Is the left eye of the skull on the same side of the left hand of the skull, too? Because the skull ain't got not a bit of a hand at all. Oh, never mind. I got the left eye now.
Then let the beetle drop through it as far as the string will reach. But be careful, and don't let go of the string.
It's done, Master Will. Look out for the gold ball below.
The beetle appeared at the end of the string and glistened like a globe of burnished gold in the last rays of the setting sun. Legrand cleared the spot directly beneath the gold bug, and at the precise spot where the beetle fell, drove a peg into the ground.
Here, hold this tape measure at the point of the tree trunk nearest the peg. That's it. Now, we'll mark off exactly 50 feet in the direction established by the two points of the tree and the peg.
Legrand measured off the distance and then drove another peg.
Bring the digging tools. Let's clear this spot and get started.
We dug very steadily for 2 hours, saying little. We had reached a depth of 5 feet and yet no sign of anything. I began to wonder if poor Legrand had been infected with some of the innumerable southern superstitions about buried treasure, and if the gold bug, as he also called it now, had not assisted his lunacy. Still, I could not understand the presence of the skull in the tree, or how Legrand had apparently known of its existence. We continued to dig, excavating to a further depth of 2 feet. Still, nothing appeared. At a signal from Legrand, Jupiter began to gather up the tools. Then we turned in profound silence toward home. Suddenly, Legrand seized Jupiter by the collar.
Jupiter, you scoundrel. Answer me this instant, without lying. Which is your left eye?
Master Wheeler, ain't this here my left eye for certain?
The terrified Jupiter placed his hand upon his right eye.
I thought so. I knew it. Come, we must go back. The game's not up yet. Tell me, Jupiter, was the skull nailed to the limb with the face outward or with the face to the limb?
The face was out, so that the crows could get at the eyes good without any trouble.
Well, then, which eye did you drop the beetle through?
Here Legrand touched each of Jupiter's eyes.
It was this eye, Massa, the left eye, as you tell me.
Jupiter reached up and touched his right eye again.
That will do. We must try it again.
Now Legrand removed the peg which marked the spot where the gold bug fell to a spot about 3 inches to the westward of its former position. Taking now the tape measure from the nearest point of the trunk to the peg as before, and continuing the extension in a straight line to the distance of 50 feet, a spot was arrived at several yards from where we had been digging.
We must again set to work with the spades.
I'm dreadfully weary, Legrand, but I am determined to see this strange adventure of yours through to the end. You're either on to something or you're completely mad, and I intend to find out which.
Let's begin.
We dug eagerly, working perhaps an hour and a half with practically no stopping. The dog seemed to expect some discovery. And when Jupiter attempted to muzzle him, the dog leapt into the hole and tore frantically at the dirt with his claws. In a few seconds, he had uncovered a mass of human bones, forming 2 complete skeletons, intermingled with several buttons of metal. 1 or 2 strokes of a spade upturned the blade of a large Spanish knife, and 3 or 4 loose pieces of gold coins.
This is not what I expected, but keep digging.
His words were hardly uttered when I stumbled and fell forward, having caught the toe of my boot in a large ring of iron that lay half buried in the loose earth.
Well, look at this. Jupiter, scrape that dirt away. Here, let's dig around this discovery.
Why, it's a chest. It was one of the iron rings I tripped on.
There's 3 of them on each side, so 6 people could carry it.
The chest was 3 feet and a half long, 3 feet broad, and 2.5 feet deep. As Jupiter had said, it was apparently designed to be carried by 6 men, and our efforts to move it failed because of its great weight. After some difficulty, we slid back the 2 bolts and opened the chest. As the rays of the lanterns fell within the pit, there flashed upward a glow and a glare from a confused heap of gold and jewels that absolutely dazzled our eyes. Jupiter fell upon his knees in the pit and, burying his naked arms up to the elbows in gold, let them remain there.
And all this come of the gold bug, that pretty gold bug.
I suggest we remove some of the contents and leave Jupiter and the dog to guard it, while you and I carry the chest and whatever treasure we can back to the hut. Jup, we'll return before daylight. Don't stir from this spot. Do you understand?
Old Jup ain't going nowhere till you get back. No, sir.
We then hurriedly made for home with the chest. After excessive toil, we arrived at the hut about 1 o'clock in the morning. We rested till 2, had supper, then carrying 3 stout sacks returned for the remainder of the booty. A little before 4, we arrived at the pit, divided the treasure equally among us, and leaving the holes unfilled, again set out for the hut. We arrived and deposited our golden burdens just as the first faint streaks of the dawn gleamed from over the treetops in the east.
Wake up! Wake up! Jup, fix us something to eat, and let's examine our treasure.
And what a treasure!
Yes, Master Will. Thanks to that old gold bug.
The chest had been full to the brim, and we spent the whole day and the greater part of the next night sorting and counting the contents. In coins, there were more than $450,000, estimating the value of the pieces as accurately as we could by the tables of the period. All was gold of antique date, French, Spanish, and German, with a few English guineas. There was no American money. The value of the jewels we found more difficult in estimating. There were diamonds, 110 in all, 18 rubies of remarkable beauty, 310 emeralds, all very fine, and 21 sapphires, with one opal, along with numerous finger and earrings and other gold articles. The weight of these valuables exceeded 350 pounds. We estimated the entire contents of the chest that night at 1.5 million. Finally, Legrand began his explanation of the riddle of the treasure.
You remember the night when I handed you the rough sketch I had made of the beetle?
Mm-hmm.
A drawing which you insisted resembled a death's head. Your comment about my artistic powers irritated me, and I was about to crumple it up and throw it into the fire.
In the scrap of paper, you mean?
No. It had much of the appearance of paper. And at first, I supposed it to be such. But it was actually a piece of very thin parchment. It was quite dirty, you remember.
Oh, yes.
Well, as I was in the very act of crumpling it up, my glance fell upon the sketch. And you may imagine my astonishment when I also saw the figure of a death's head, just where I had made the drawing of the beetle. Upon turning it over, however, I discovered my own sketch upon the reverse, just as I had made it. But then I was puzzled, for I distinctly remembered that there had been no drawing upon the parchment when I made my sketch.
No one had it after you drew the sketch until you gave it to me.
Quite true. When you had gone, and when Jupiter was fast asleep, I began to investigate the whole affair. I had found the scrap of parchment lying half buried near an old boat wreck. Jupiter had wrapped the gold bug in it, and though I had loaned the beetle to the lieutenant from the fort, as you would recall, I had kept the parchment in my pocket. Then I hit upon the connection.
What connection?
Between the wrecked boat and the parchment. The skull, or death's head, is the emblem of the pirate.
But you said that the skull was not upon the parchment when you made the drawing of the beetle. How then do you trace any connection between the boat and the skull?
There was no skull apparent upon the parchment. You will remember that night when you came, it was chilly, luckily, and a fire was blazing upon the hearth.
Oh, yes, yes.
Just after I handed you my sketch, Jup let the dog in, which made a good deal of fuss over you, as usual.
Well, what does all this have to do with the mysterious skull?
Patience, my dear man. While you were playing with the dog, you held the parchment very close to the fire. I remember distinctly, for I was about to caution you, but then Jup took the dog away and you began to examine my drawing. I realized that the heat had been the agent in bringing to light, upon the parchment, the skull which you saw.
So it was there all the time.
Exactly. After you left, I kindled another fire and subjected every portion of the parchment to a glowing heat. At last, there became visible at the corner, opposite to the spot where the skull appeared, the figure of what I had first supposed to be a goat. A closer look satisfied me it was intended for a kid.
I have no right to laugh at you. 1.5 million is too serious a matter for mirth, but surely you're not about to establish a link in your chain between pirates and a goat. Pirates have nothing to do with goats. They're related to farmers, my dear Legrand.
But I had said that the figure was not that of a goat.
Well, a kid, then, pretty much the same thing.
Pretty much, but not altogether. You may have heard of one Captain Kidd.
Great Scott, Legrand.
Lord have mercy.
I suppose Jupiter's talk about the bug being of solid gold had a remarkable effect upon my fancy. But I had a feeling that some great good fortune was about to befall me.
And what coincidences! That the fire should have been burning and that the dog should have come in just as I was about to examine the parchment.
Precisely. Well, I continued to examine the parchment, cleaning it and heating it upon a pan of lighted charcoal. Then appeared the figures arranged in lines, just as you see it now.
Here, Legrand, having reheated the parchment, brought it for my inspection. Between the death's head and the goat, or kid, were four lines of rudely traced characters and numbers.
I made up my mind at once that this was a simple riddle which would be easily solved.
And you really solved it?
Readily. Since the word kid, corresponding to Captain Kidd, was English, I assumed the cryptograph would be in English also. Therefore, I constructed a table of the characters and numbers according to their frequency. Now, in English, the letter E occurs most frequently. Afterward, A, O, I, D, and so on. By substituting the letters for the characters on the parchment, I soon deciphered the riddle.
So this is it written out. A good glass in the bishop's hostel, in the devil's seat. 41 degrees and 13 minutes northeast and by north, main branch, seventh limb, east side. Shoot from the left eye of the death's head, a beeline from the tree, through the shot, 50 feet out. I'm still in the dark. What meaning did you find in all this jargon about devil's seats, death's heads, and bishop's hostels?
It left me in the dark for a few days. Then I discovered that the bishop's hostel might have some reference to an old family of the name of Bessop, which lived northward of the island. An old Negro woman on the place remembered such a landmark as Bessop's castle, but that it was a high rock and not a castle, or hotel, as I had suspected. Climbing to the top, my eyes fell upon a narrow ledge in the east face of the rock, which resembled one of our hollow-backed chairs. I was certain that here was the devil's seat referred to on the parchment.
So you had found the devil's seat in the bishop's hostel, but what of the good glass and the rest?
The good glass I knew must be a telescope. So the next day, returning with a telescope, I seated myself in the devil's seat. I followed the directions, arriving at a point where I perceived a white spot through the telescope. Adjusting the focus, I again looked, and now made it out to be a human skull.
That poor old skull nailed to that tree.
And the seventh branch, east side, was where the skull was nailed to the tree?
Correct. Shoot from the left eye of the death's head, meant to drop a bullet from the left eye of the skull to get a point on the ground.
Though you decided to substitute the gold bug instead.
A beeline through the shot or point 50 feet out was merely a straight line from the tree trunk through the point where the beetle dropped to the exact location of the buried treasure.
I suppose you missed the spot in the first attempt because Jupiter let the bug fall through the right instead of the left eye of the skull.
Precisely. Although this mistake made a difference of only 2.5 inches in the shot or point, the error increased as we proceeded with the line, and by the time we had gone 50 feet, threw us quite off the scent.
Yes. Well, there's only one point which puzzles me. What are we to make of the skeletons found in the hole?
I'm no more able to answer that than yourself. It is clear that Captain Kidd must have had assistance in the labor of burying the treasure. But, this labor concluded, he may have thought it necessary to remove all who knew his secret. Perhaps a couple of blows were sufficient. While his men were busy in the pit, perhaps it required a dozen. Who shall tell?
Listen again next week for another unforgettable story from our Springbok Library of the Air.